WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Carolyn Heilbrunn is a feminist professor of literature. She collects biographies and is a student of the form. In her new book, Writing a Woman's Life, she observes that men's stories are usually described as quests, whereas women have only two narratives available to them, the conventional marriage and the erotic plot. Heilbrunn wants to suggest new ways of writing about the lives of women. Heilbrunn is especially interested in unconventional women. She's created such a woman in the detective novel she writes under the pen name of Amanda Cross. But when it comes to autobiography, Heilbrunn finds that even unconventional women follow convention when telling their own stories.
What's most interesting is when extraordinary women write autobiographies. They've had extraordinary lives, but they write about themselves as though it all just sort of happened, and they reluctantly filled the role of head of state or whatever it might be, because women simply were not allowed to admit to ambition or power, the desire for power, or which could they say they ever suffered. It was always other people who suffered.
What's an example of a autobiography like that that you have in mind?
Jane Addams, Golda Meir, Eleanor Roosevelt. My favorite is Ida Tarbell, who brought down the Standard Oil of New Jersey single-handed, and who in her autobiography just happened to meet someone who happened to come along when she happened to be sewing. Their letters, of course, are very different.
In an earlier book, you wrote about androgyny, and you said the ideal toward which I believe we should move is best described by the term androgyny. I'd like to know what you meant by androgyny and if you still feel that way.
What I meant at the time, and one has to remember that when I wrote that book, the term androgyny was very new indeed and very frightening.
And this is what year?
It came out in 1973, and it was not the common word it has become since. And many book reviewers became very upset by it.
They probably thought you meant a hermaphrodite.
Yes, or they thought you meant heaven knows what. I mean, we rely so much on stereotypical views of gender. As I say somewhere in the book, quoting someone, a man only is a man by defining himself against women. When I wrote this, I hoped for an ideal of a spectrum along which individuals could take their places without regard to the appropriate. The term androgyny has actually become less in favor with feminists whom I honor because it does seem to insist upon only two, a binomial sense, which is probably not good, because the media took it up so much, and because in history, while men always were willing to adopt certain feminine qualities, they resented very much women's adopting masculine ones.
Since your new book is about women who've lived unconventional lives and how their stories have been told in autobiography or biography, I'm interested a little bit in your life and if you were interested when you were young in living an unconventional life.
Oh, no. Nobody dared to live an unconventional life in the 1950s. I was unconventional, amazingly enough, in not having children until I was what was then considered very old, 30. Now I think that's rather young to have a child. And I never moved to the suburbs because I didn't want to be a chauffeur and so on, and I always worked. I suppose those made me unconventional, but of course I hid it behind an extraordinarily conventional life, which I still live. and that does make me a little questionable, I think.
What do you mean it makes you questionable?
Well, it's very easy to urge other people to a kind of courage one never had to have oneself.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, since I'm older, I've become much more courageous and feisty and so on. And that's why I think, one of the reasons I think it's such an opportunity.
Why do you think you've become more courageous since you've gotten older?
Well, partly, of course, it's the women's movement. There are more women out there. We talk to each other. You don't feel all alone and peculiar and odd, at least not on the East Coast. Also, you know, there's nothing more they can do to me.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, my children are grown. I've got a job. What can they do to me? Only what they've already done, which is call me a feminist and so forth. One has to have the courage then to speak to young people, to speak for young people, I mean to say, who, after all, have to worry about keeping their jobs, raising their children, and so on, and they can't take these risks. So I think we who are older have to take them for them.
When you were young, you started reading the British detective novelist Dorothy Sayers, and her work was very important to you, and I guess was responsible in part for you eventually writing detective novels. What did you find in her novels that really spoke to you?
Well, first of all, the English detective novels were all about intelligent people who sat around chatting to each other. They weren't like these American ones with a lot of men killing each other and beating each other up and bleeding all over the place. So, first of all, I liked that. Second of all, of course, I was an Anglophile. I taught and still teach British literature. But also her whole sense, I mean, if you speak about androgyny, the Sayers and the other women and some of the men writers, their characters, the men and women, are not locked in prisons of gender. You know, they are people, and they talk to each other. And then with Sayers and Gaudy Knight, of course, she gave us the first real community of intelligent women, and that was an extraordinary thing to do.
In 1964, you started writing detective fiction under the pen name of Amanda Cross. What did you want to write within that genre?
I wanted to see what a woman who had everything, that is to say, she had enough money, which you have to have so you can hop on a plane to chase a criminal and so forth, and who had a job, had education, had everything, what she could do with it that was more than what it seemed to me women were doing around the world. And she was, of course, a fantasy figure. She's got a little more realistic lately.
Why did you write under a pen name instead of using your own?
Because I knew I wouldn't get tenure if they knew I was writing detective novels. It's that simple.
Is popular culture that despised in academia?
Yeah, well, they wouldn't say they despise it, but you shouldn't be spending your time writing novels. You should be spending your time writing critical articles. And it was much worse when I was young than it is now, probably.
Was anyone ever onto you?
No, I must say it was a perfectly kept secret until 1972. After I wrote Poetic Justice, a few people began to guess. That's the one that takes place at a university that might be thought to be Columbia.
So did anyone confront you with it?
Oh, yes, a good bit after that. And then the secret was out and it didn't matter. But it was totally a secret before then.
Do you still see academia as a good place for furthering feminist thought?
Oh, yes, very much so. As I said in the beginning of my book, Writing a Woman's Life, the only problem is that the feminist theoreticians in academia have been so brilliant and have gone so far. They've really been extraordinary. And I worry that that is not being translated sufficiently into something both available and interesting to more women all over who need it. Not that that's the job of the academicians by any means, but, you know, the media picks up whatever is easy and sexy and so forth.
You know, it's interesting to me that several really interesting feminist thinkers have devoted some of their writing to literary criticism. Even the Second Sex, one of the most important feminist texts and one of the first in the resurgence of feminism, had several chapters devoted to literature in it.
Well, that's right, because mainly that's where we get our stories from, at least before television. We got our stories from literature. We got our stories from the books we read and so forth. And literature, of course, even when it was written mostly by men, and this is something I find very interesting, they use women characters very much in ways that question the whole gender structure, even at the same time that they uphold it. It's the business of literary people to understand what goes on underneath the text, and that's why they do this very well and use literature.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.